This is Pepper reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for March 29, 2023. Rig ID evolves into premier apparel brand by Ben Schaffer. Al Escamilla's passion for clothing ignited some 40 years ago when his high school friends used to pay him to distress and fade their jeans at his parents' laundromat. Fast forward to 2023, Rig ID, he and his wife Krista's apparel business, outfits oil and gas workers across Midland and West Texas with flame-resistant uniforms while creating stylish, casual outerwear and hats. Around 2003, the Escamillas partnered with a Mexican brand to begin making T-shirts. Although they admit they didn't have much knowledge of the business at the time, they got an opportunity to present their apparel for Nordstrom through a connection they made at a party. The pair took 13 of their designs to then-regional Nordstrom buyers in Dallas, stayed at the Galleria, and presented their product. After the pitch, Nordstrom personnel took the Escamillas to the basement of their Dallas location and said they wanted to write a purchase order for their clothing. They said, "Okay, we're ready to write a PO." And we looked at each other and were like, "What's a PO?" Krista said. The Escamillas apparel was in around 30 Nordstrom locations until the 2008 financial crisis, when Nordstrom downsized and ceased doing business with them. The couple said they learned a lot from the experience. "That's how you learn and grow. You make mistakes, you learn from those mistakes, and you get to do better next time," Krista said. Rig ID opened in April 2015. That's when Krista, a longtime television personality now with KWES, would receive press releases about fatalities in the oil field. A couple weeks later, we would get another email saying, "Sorry, we don't know the next of kin because they didn't have identification on them," she said. The original concept for Rig ID was to create an identification bracelet for workers on oil rigs that included contact information and companies' phone numbers. Al's passion for clothing drove him to delve deeper into the idea of safety equipment for oil workers and create flame-resistant workwear. Al admits he wasn't sure if his new company would survive, establishing themselves just after the city's oil boom in 2014. He decided to take a chance and make a call to Pioneer Natural Resources. He spoke to Pioneer personnel, told them he had just opened an FR, flame-resistant clothing store, and wanted to set up a meeting. She says, "Today's your lucky day." And I said, "Really?" She said, "We just decided not to renew our contract with our uniform provider," Al recalled. Pioneer became Rig ID's first uniform client, and the Escamillas started in the coverall business. Over time, Rig ID evolved from workwear to all kinds of outerwear, like hats, hoodies, polo shirts, athletic wear, vests, fleeces, and more. Customers can customize some Rig ID products to make them their own. Small business owners looking to grow need a few tools, according to the Escamillas. Practically, Al said proficiency in sales and marketing, cost control, and software like Microsoft Excel, Shopify, and QuickBooks are essential. Krista claimed flexibility is key, saying if her and her husband couldn't adjust and evolve over time, they'd be out of business. Rig ID will release thin FR clothing, an example of that evolving. Rig ID listened to their customers, oilfield workers who needed a thinner, more breathable, flame-resistant uniform set for West Texas heat. Rig ID will roll theirs out this year. MISD approves police force expansion by Stuart Doring. Midland ISD school board members approved a three-year plan to expand the district's police department Monday night. Board members heard from MISD Police Chief Arthur Barkley, who requested 16 new police personnel be added over three phases, starting in the 2023-24 school year. That proposal to provide more safety and security at MISD's elementary campuses included seven additional positions are proposed for 2023-24, four additional positions are proposed for 2024-25, five additional positions are proposed for 2025-26. Midland ISD's current organizational chart shows a police chief, lieutenant, sergeant, and 16 officers. Barclay said that there are currently four vacancies but expects at least three of those positions to be filled soon. The addition of six officers and a sergeant next school year will put an officer on each secondary campus, and six officers would cover the district's elementary campuses and pre-K facilities. The addition of four officers in 2024-25 will give the district 10 officers covering elementary campuses. The plan for 2025-26 calls for two more elementary campus officers, bringing the total to 12, two investigative officers, and a third sergeant. The plan, according to Barkley, will allow for two officers to be trained as designated investigators to handle priority investigations in a more timely and effective manner. The ratio of officers to elementary students would drop from 1 to 2,760 in 2023-24 to 1 to 1,380 in 2025-26. The total proposal cost over the 3 years is $1.938 million. Funds will come from MISD's budget, except for a Midland County Law Enforcement grant in 2023-24. Council passes indoor athletic complex land lease. Editor's note. The reporter telegram talked with developers of the indoor athletic complex being planned in West Midland. A more complete report will appear in a future edition. By Stuart Doring. Midlanders packed the council chamber at Midland City Hall on Tuesday to see how city leaders would vote on a new indoor athletic complex. There wasn't much for attendees to take in. The Midland City Council unanimously supported a land lease with the Midland Athletic Syndicate, the nonprofit wanting to build an indoor facility at the Scarborough Sports Complex. And not only did the council pass the item, there was no discussion, just an affirmation of the item as it was part of the council's consent agenda. Since the item wasn't pulled, those who attended the meeting to provide comment if needed filtered out of council chambers with a victory in hand. Afterward, Austin Campbell and John Scarborough, representing the syndicate, told the reporter Telegram that the facility concept developers have in mind is based on a facility in Abilene, the Dodge Jones Center. However, they said the indoor complex they have in mind for Midland will include 103,000 square feet, 6 full-size basketball courts, 12 volleyball courts, and indoor soccer space. Campbell said an early estimate of the cost of the facility is around $30 million. It will be raised entirely with private funds and add a missing piece of the sports tournament puzzle. I think it was a huge win today, Midland Mayor Lori Blong said after the meeting. And I think that the evidence was all the support that they had in the audience, all the people that had filled out supportive notes to us, and we received emails of encouragement to support this project. But then also people showed up today to make their voice heard, not even wishing to speak, but just to, by their presence, to say this is something we believe Midland needs. Campbell said that the syndicate has received overwhelming support from all council members during the process. So I think everybody's excited for us to move forward and get something built that everybody's proud of, Campbell said. Council approves MDC's deal with Midland Complex Developer. By Stuart Doreen. Let the construction of Bass Pro Shops begin. The Midland City Council unanimously approved a resolution authorizing a master development agreement between the MDC, City of Midland, and C. Hodges Development Services for the multi-million-dollar entertainment and retail complex. The item was part of a consent agenda that was passed Tuesday without comment. C. Hodges Development Services plans a $45 million entertainment retail complex on 17.345 acres at that intersection. Under the master development agreement, the MDC has agreed to contribute up to $5 million in infrastructure funding for roads, drainage, water, and other infrastructure. That includes two roads, an east-west extension of Sinclair Avenue, and a new north-south road. Once complete, all infrastructure will be dedicated to the City of Midland. Bass Pro Shops is expected to be the anchor tenant, occupying a 60,000-square-foot pad designated for a national retailer. The site plan also includes a pad for a 60,000-square-foot, two-story family cinema and entertainment center, complete with an outdoor music and event stage, and platted lots for other general retailers and restaurants. The proposed entertainment retail complex is located at State Highway 191 and State Highway 158. The operator of the Family Cinema and Entertainment Center has not been named. Bass Pro Shops previously announced in a press release it plans to open a retail store in Midland in late 2024. Bass also stated in a press release that it expects to employ more than 115 outfitters at its new Midland location, many of whom will come from the local region. The store will be Bass Pro Shops' 17th in Texas. Bass Pro Shops looks forward to partnering with the City of Midland and the Midland Development Corporation to bring the widest selection of hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation gear in the industry with an inventory tailored to the region, the news release stated. MPD responds to three convenience store robberies, Midland Reporter Telegram. The Midland Police Department reported responding to three aggravated robberies at convenience stores across Midland on Sunday. In the early morning hours, Midland Police responded to DK Convenience Store at 2600 North Midland Drive at approximately 4 a.m., DK Convenience Store at 4415 North Garfield Street at approximately 5 a.m., Stripes Convenience Store at 4508 North Big String Street at approximately 5:30 a.m. All clerks stated the black male suspect walked in with a black handgun and demanded all the money out of the register, then fled on foot, MPD reported. It is believed that the male parks a vehicle down the street and then approaches on foot and leaves the same way. If you have any information on the suspect in the pictures, please contact the Midland Police Department non-emergency number 432-685-7108. Pfluger hosts news conference highlighting energy bill by Mella McEwen. As the Lower Energy Costs Act starts its legislative journey this week, Republican congressmen are working to garner support. Congressman August Pfluger, whose 11th district includes much of the Permian Basin, serves as chairman of the Republican Study Committee's House Energy Action Team and hosted a press conference Tuesday to highlight provisions of the legislation. He was joined by Majority Leader Steve Scalise, Republican Louisiana, Republican Study Committee Chairman Kevin Hern, Republican Oklahoma, and members of the HEAT team. I am proud to represent the hardworking men and women of the Permian Basin, the heartbeat of American energy production. When we talk oil and gas, we're talking about my constituents. I am here to defend them every single day, Pfluger stated during the press conference. The San Angelo Republican continued, "This week, we are delivering on our promises to restore American energy dominance. H.R. 1, the Lower Energy Costs Act, is a complete rejection of the Biden administration's anti-energy policies that have been aimed at the workers and families in my district for the past 2 years. We are fighting back against the president's attacks by boosting energy production in America to stop runaway inflation and make sure the U.S. is not reliant on foreign adversaries for energy. I am extremely proud to have worked on this legislation that includes my bill to repeal President Biden's harmful new tax on American oil and gas producers to allow LNG and American producers to increase production. This is just the beginning. The RSC House Energy Action Team will continue leading the charge to advance even more pro-energy reforms and restore American energy dominance." U.S. New Mexico settle with oil company over emissions, Associated Press. Albuquerque, New Mexico. A Texas oil company has reached a $6.2 million settlement with the federal government and the state of New Mexico to resolve air pollution violations. State and federal environmental regulators announced the settlement with Matador Production Company on Monday. They say the company agreed to comply with clean air regulations at all of its 239 oil and natural gas well pads in New Mexico, which is home to part of the Permian Basin, one of the most productive oil and gas regions in the world. Regulators had accused the company of failing to capture and control emissions from its storage tanks. They also say that the company failed to obtain required permits at more than 24 of its production operations in the state. Matador said it already had seen improvements in operations and emissions control since 2019. The company pointed to 2022 emissions data for its gross operated production and exploration operations, saying the intensity of direct greenhouse gas emissions decreased by 55% and methane emissions by 70%. The company said it made changes to its maintenance and repair program to help avoid preventable emissions and noted that using aerial monitoring and other technology will help in what Matador and government regulators describe as an ongoing effort. State and federal officials said the alleged violations had resulted in excess emissions of volatile organic compounds, nitrogen oxide, and carbon monoxide. The emissions were identified through flyover surveillance and field investigations done in 2019. Under the settlement agreement, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the New Mexico Environment Department said Matador will be the first producer to implement measures that will serve as a model in future resolutions involving other producers. This settlement begins to hold the ninth largest oil and gas producer in our state accountable and mitigate the harmful impacts to our communities and ability to breathe clean air, said Environment Secretary James Kenney in a statement. Air quality at risk in Permian Basin. Assistant Attorney General Todd Kim with the Justice Department's Environment and Natural Resources Division said air quality in the Permian Basin, which also spans parts of West Texas, is at risk of not meeting national standards and that federal regulators will continue working with New Mexico regulators to make sure oil companies follow the law. The EPA and the state estimate that Matador's compliance will result in a combined reduction of more than 16,000 tons of nitrogen oxide, volatile organic compounds, and carbon monoxide. Greenhouse gases such as methane also will decrease as a result. As part of the settlement, Matador will pay a civil penalty of $1.15 million and will pay for aerial monitoring of its New Mexico facilities and for a supplemental environmental project involving diesel engine replacements. Texas students are behind in education, expected to lose $104 billion in future earnings, by Erica Greider, Houston Chronicle. Texas students are falling behind, and it will cost them dearly in terms of future earnings, according to a new report. A report on student readiness from the George W. Bush Institute and Texas 2036 estimates 70% of jobs in Texas will require a post-secondary credential by 2036. But just 22% of Texas 8th graders earn such a credential within 6 years of high school graduation. Students are considered ready if they have the skills and knowledge to succeed in the next grade or post-graduation. The report says today's Texas 8th graders can expect to lose out on $104 billion in future earnings due to a lack of readiness, with low-income students bearing the brunt, two-thirds of that cost. This may not represent a direct threat to the state's booming economy, the report notes, because workers moving to Texas are generally more highly educated than those raised here, but that should be a concern for policymakers in itself, the authors argue. Today, those who move to Texas are better educated than those who grow up here, making Texas's children at risk of being left out of the state's future prosperity and relegated to second-class status behind their out-of-state peers, the report says. The report was released days after the Texas Education Agency announced a takeover of Houston Independent School District, and as government Greg Abbott touts a controversial measure to bring a large-scale voucher program to Texas. The George W. Bush Institute and Texas 2036 report, which focuses on public education, urges policymakers to focus on measurement and accountability. The state embraced two such efforts in the 1980s, it notes. Standards-based reform and student data disaggregated by race, gender, and income, leading to improvements in student outcomes by the 1990s. Far too many young Texans will be left behind in our booming economy if we don't act, said Ann Wicks, Director of Education and Opportunity at the George W. Bush Institute. MISD turns over Lamar to charter operator, by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD board members voted late Monday night to turn over Lamar Elementary to a charter operator and avoid a Texas Education Agency takeover or the shutting down of the school in Southwest Midland. In establishing the 1882 partnership with Third Future Schools out of Colorado, the board followed the recommendation from Superintendent Stephanie Howard's administration. Lamar was heading toward a fifth straight failing grade, something which forced the district's hand. District officials reported Monday that MISD had received a letter from the Texas Education Agency reminding them of Lamar's status as a campus with four straight failing marks, one of the longest streaks in the state of Texas. The letter stated that should Lamar finish the year with a failing mark, it would have two choices. The first is the TEA takeover. The second is a scenario like the one that played out with the former Crockett Elementary, now General Franks Elementary. In 2017, Midland's ISD leaders, based on Crockett's failing record, closed down the campus, moved the students to other schools, created new leadership, filled the school with different students, and renamed the school General Franks Elementary. In making a move with Lamar prior to the completion of a fifth straight failing year, Midland ISD officials by law are allowed to enter into the partnership with Third Future. Midland ISD has taken this step twice before, partnering with IDEA Public Schools after the failing streak at Travis Elementary in Southeast Midland and partnering with Third Future after the failing streak of Houston Collegiate Prep in Central Midland. The vote was 5-2 to partner with Third Future, with Tommy Bishop and Michael Booker voting against the partnership. The other trustees generally showed support for Howard's administration to be able to fix the problems with the district and its handling of long-term failing campuses. Third Future has a proven track record within our district, said District 4 Representative Katie Joyner in a statement sent to the Reporter-Telegram prior to the meeting. The expansion of this successful partnership to Lamar is the right move for improving academic outcomes for those students at this point in time. The new administration now has the opportunity to demonstrate that they are capable of turning around long-term failing schools in this next chapter of MISD, and they will have my support. Midland ISD Board President Brian Murray took ownership of the Lamar struggles, which go back to the middle of the previous decade. The district reported that Lamar had failed or garnered improvement required marks from the 2014-15 school year to the 2017-18 school year. In 2018-19, Lamar recorded a letter grade of D, which basically was a pause for the campus. After the COVID pandemic, Lamar continued its struggle with a 59 in 2021-22. MISD officials reported Monday there wasn't much reason for optimism that Lamar would score a C or better. Murray insisted that Lamar's inability to turn around was on the board and that district leaders should have been more insistent on getting the school more resources and Lamar's teachers the training they needed. He said current Lamar teachers will not lose their jobs and will be pulled back into the district or can apply for jobs with Third Future at Lamar. It is in the best interest of the students to give them opportunity to turn their education around, Murray said. District 6 Representative Sarah Burleson stated that a hard reset is needed for the campus and that it wasn't fair we have done this to the students. As an educator, it makes me really sad, Burleson said. We need to right this ship for the students. District 5 Representative Brandon Hodges spoke directly about the lack of time Midland ISD gave Lamar parents about the change to the campus. He then reminded those individuals making millions of dollars on Missouri Avenue, home of Midland ISD's central office, that they signed up to improve student outcomes across the district. He added he will be hell on wheels if another school ends up in the same situation as Lamar. Midland ISD reported earlier in the meeting that Scarber, Bunch, and De Zavala went into the 2022-23 school year with failing grades. I want to hold people accountable for results, and the results are terrible right now, Hodges told the Reporter Telegram after the meeting. And so in order to turn these schools around, we need to have a plan, and we need to do it in advance so we don't end up in the same situation over and over again. I believe that Dr. Howard can do it, but I'm going to hold her accountable because this is the last school we're going to have to turn over and essentially say the MISD school board is incapable of governing schools and that the independent boards are better at it than we are because we have to constantly turn them over. So I just think it's fair to hold people accountable. Obituaries. Lily Mae Rogers, 71, passed away on March 26, 2023 at Ballinger Healthcare and Rehab in Ballinger, Texas. Lily was born on March 2, 1952 in Midland, Texas, to parents James Allen and Flora Pauline Smith Rogers. Visitation will be Wednesday, March 29th from 9 a.m. to noon at the funeral home in Robert Lee. Graveside services will be held the same day at Edith Paint Creek Cemetery at 2 p.m., Online condolences can be made at shafferpioneer.com. That's shafferpioneer.com. Funeral arrangements were trusted to Shaffer Funeral Home, Sherwood Way, 1939 Sherwood Way, San Angelo, Texas, 76901, 325-224-2828. Robert Emmett Bob Puller died on February 22, 2023 in Granbury. A memorial service will be held on Saturday, April 1st at the Episcopal Church of the Holy Trinity in Midland at 11 a.m. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that contributions be made to Interim Healthcare and Hospice of Granbury, 1314 Paluxy Road, Granbury, Texas, 76048, or Holy Trinity Episcopal Church, 1412 West Illinois Avenue, Midland, Texas, 79701. Bill Lively passed away peacefully in his home March 24, 2023. Bill was born October 9, 1930, to Dan and Kitty Lively in McCamey, Texas. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests donations be made to an animal shelter or charity of your choice. A graveside service will take place at 11 a.m. Thursday, March 30th, 2023, at Rest Haven Memorial Park, 4616 North Big Spring Street, Midland, Texas. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
This is Thoris with the Odessa American News for Wednesday, March the 29th. Headlines: Parks and Rec Director Calls It Quits. Steve Patton, the City of Odessa's Parks and Recreation Director, unexpectedly retired Monday, effective immediately. Patton had been with the city more than 32 years. Patton, 63, was the driving force behind growing the Starbright Village holiday display that draws thousands every holiday season. Over the last three decades, the lighted display has grown each year. Patton also oversaw changing multiple city pools from just pools to aquatic centers and the recently completed redo of Floyd Gwynn Park. In addition, he was at the helm when the city took over the public golf course. I just thought the timing was good for me to retire. We've got things happening. We've got good staff in place. I miss my family. We had a couple of recent family reunions that I missed because of work events, Patton said. I've occupied so much of my time with work, with thinking about it, and the timing was just good for me to make that decision. While the rumors swirling about his departure being somewhat tied to a personnel matter within his department are not false, Patton said ultimately he left the city because he wanted to. I want to respectfully know that I did something positive for Odessa. I've spent 32 years of my life trying to make a positive difference in Odessa, and especially for the children of this community. I hope I establish something that is like the premiere of a series and somebody else can pick up the ball now and continue the episodes of making the Parks and Recreation Department the quality of life better for Odessa. That's what I want to leave on. In terms of legacy, Patton said he is especially proud of the family aquatic centers at Woodson and Sherwood Parks, both of which have served as models for other communities. Starbright Village is also a highlight because of the incredible attendance and the many, many smiling faces they see every year, Patton said. The aquatic centers, Starbright Village, and the city's other programs have made such a positive difference in the quality of life for everybody that attends, he said. Patton said he received two job offers Tuesday, but is looking forward to relaxing a bit. I've not had a vacation since 1995, and I've not missed a day of work since 1995. The amount of hours and dedication that I have put into Odessa has taken its toll on me. I've got to do something, make some changes in my life for the positive. I'm not young anymore, Patton said. At least 17 city employees have retired since November, including Assistant City Manager Cindy Muncy, Odessa Fire Chief John Alvarez, OFR Assistant Chiefs Rod Huber, and Saul Ortega, Director of Development Randy Brinlin, and OFR Training Chief Martin Moya. OFR Assistant Chief Joey White retired in September. Since the City Council voted 5-2 to terminate City Manager Michael Marrero and City Attorney Natasha Brooks on December the 13th, the city has also lost three of its five city attorneys and Randy Pineda, who spent 21 years as the assistant to the city manager. In addition, the city also fired Assistant City Manager Aaron Smith earlier this month. Interim City Manager Agapito Burnell, Mayor Javier Joven, and Council Members Mark Mata, Denise Swanner, Chris Haney, and Greg Connell did not respond to a text or email either. However, Director of Communications Monica McDaniel released the following statement on behalf of Burnell. Quote, "We are so grateful to have those who have served our city and its citizens for decades. It's evident the city of Odessa is a place where you can have a successful career, make a difference in our community, and then retire and enjoy your golden years," end quote. Odessa City Council members Gilbert Vasquez, who spent more than 30 years with the Ector County Independent School District, said he is concerned about all the departures. "No, this is not typical," Vasquez said. "I do have concerns not only as a city councilman, but as a city community member that so many of our experienced individuals heading up very important departments are no longer with us because of retirement or resignation." Although he's only been on the council since November, Vasquez said he had assumed, given Patton's tenure, He must have done a good job under former city managers Richard Morton and Marrero. I would think that his longevity spoke for itself, Vasquez said, while he also hopes retirees are replaced by people who have been trained and mentored. Vasquez noted on an employee survey conducted by T2 Professional Consulting revealed many employees complained about a lack of training and mentorship. City Council member Steve Thompson is also worried about all the departures. Patton's is especially troublesome because the city is currently discussing the feasibility of a multi-million dollar sports complex. At this point, it was a personnel issue. That's really all I can really say. It's not my desire to get involved, but the problem I have with it is it's the wrong time. We're losing all of our experience and all of our knowledge, and we have all these things going on. Regardless what the reason was, it's very untimely, Thompson said. The city cannot afford to lose all of these long-term employees, Thompson said. Every good private employer wants long-term employees, especially with the knowledge Steve has in parks and recs. We've got this sports complex report coming out. It's just the wrong time to lose him, he said. Also complicating matters is the fact that the city is months away from hiring a new city manager, and until that person is in place, the city can't fill the two empty assistant city manager positions, Muncy's and Smith's, Thompson said. I can tell you the loss of these people at the tops of these departments has got to have an impact. It only makes sense. Every department is putting people who are not qualified in those positions as they get rid of leadership, Thompson said. At least a handful of those who have left the city since December have expressly attributed their departure to a bad work environment. On her exit interview paperwork, Pinda wrote, I was planning to stay with the city for 30 years, but with a new council direction, I'm choosing to leave. Asked what she liked least about her job, Pinda wrote, Mayor and City Council, excluding Thompson and Vasquez. She wrote that up until December the 13th, the city was heading in a positive direction. Muncy, who retired 1 week after Brooks and Marrero were fired, left most of her exit interview paperwork blank. However, next to the box where she clicked retirement, she wrote, close to retiring and changes made the decision happen quicker. Senior Assistant City Attorney Monique Wimberly resigned after Brooks was fired, citing the disintegration of work environment. Political process became too intertwined with position. Her colleague, Jane Baker, said it was too dangerous to work for the city. I've had my bar license for 30-plus years, and I didn't want to lose it with what the mayor and his people were doing, Baker said. Odessans will need to recycle at Time Machine. If Odessans want to continue recycling, they'll have to take their materials to the Time Machine. The city of Odessa will no longer have community collection sites. Odessa City Council members have been discussing how to handle recycling for the past few months because BRI Recycling Services contract is about to expire, and the company advised the city there's not much of a market for recycling now, and what they collect in Odessa is highly contaminated. On Tuesday, Public Works Director Tom Kerr told City Council members he and BRI came up with two options for them to consider. Under both options, the city will spend $125,000 to put up new fencing at the Time Machine, purchase more 30-yard recycle containers, and remove a divider wall to accommodate the containers. A baler will also be removed at a cost of $25,000. By putting up the new fencing, the city hopes to cut down on the contamination. The Time Machine will continue to operate from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. on weekdays and from 8 a.m. to noon on Saturdays at a cost of $60,000 annually, and BRI will continue to process the materials for $30,000 annually. Their stories were lost to slavery. Now DNA is writing them. In the 1700s, a boy was born into slavery in colonial America. He spent his life working in the coastal city of Charleston, South Carolina, and when he died in middle age, he was buried alongside 35 other slaves. That's the likely history that researchers have uncovered for the man. There is no written record for him or the others buried at the long-forgotten site. Their names have been lost, along with any details of their lives. But their stories are now being told through what was left behind: bones, teeth, and especially DNA. In recent decades, advances in DNA research have allowed scientists to use ancient remains and peer into the lives of long-dead people. In Charleston, that's meant tracing some of the African roots that were cut off by slavery. "We're bringing their memories back to life," said Rachel Feskes, an anthropologist at the University of Connecticut who studied the remains. "This is a way of restoring dignity to individuals that should have always had this dignity." The Charleston Project started a decade ago when construction workers unearthed the remains beneath the grounds of the Gaillard Center, an arts venue in the city that was going through an expansion. Dating back to the second half of the 18th century, the remains are believed to be mostly from enslaved people of African descent who lived nearby. A few of them were likely among the estimated 175,000 Africans brought through Charleston's port, a hub for the transatlantic slave trade. The city reburied the remains at the site where a memorial fountain is placed. But with few recorded details available, community members were also interested in using science to learn more about the people, Feskes said. So the Anson Street African Burial Ground Project was born, and researchers started looking for clues. "Artifacts from the site showed that the bodies were buried with care," explained Theodore Schur, an anthropologist at the University of Pennsylvania who worked on the research. "Some of them had their beads in their hair or coins over their eyes. Minerals in their teeth showed only a few had been born in Africa, while most had likely been born into slavery in Charleston or nearby." One dead in West Odessa shooting. The Ector County Sheriff's Office has detained a man in the Tuesday night shooting death of another man in West Odessa. Sheriff Mike Griffiths said deputies received a shots fired call around 5:30 p.m. from a small trailer park on West Westridge Drive and North Cypress Avenue. When they arrived, they found a man believed to be in his mid-20s deceased in a driveway. They found another man of a similar age on foot around the corner from the scene and took him into custody without incident, Griffiths said. "We were told there was a physical altercation between the deceased and another individual, not the one we have in custody," Griffiths said. "The detained man was taken to the sheriff's office to be questioned," Griffiths said. "We have what we believe is the weapon that was used, a semi-automatic handgun," he said. Griffiths said the victim, who has not been identified, was shot multiple times. "It's unknown if either victim is connected to the trailer park," the sheriff said, "nor do investigators know who called 911. Midland Habitat for Humanity dedicates 187th house. On March 24th, Midland Habitat for Humanity dedicated its 187th house, located at 801 East Odessa Street, to a deserving homeowner. Made possible through the generous support of churches participating in the Apostle Build, this new home will provide a secure and affordable living space for a hard-working Odessa family. The Apostle Build is a program where local churches sponsor the construction of a habitat house from start to finish. The program is named after the 12 apostles who left their regular occupations to follow Jesus and help build his church. Similarly, participants in the Apostle Build give their time, resources, and energy to build a home for a family in need. The 187th Habitat Home Build was made possible by the financial contributions and volunteer work of the following churches: Antioch Christian Church, Connections Christian Church, Emmanuel Baptist, First Baptist Odessa, Mid-Cities Church, New Life Fellowship, and The Bridge. Their hard work and dedication helped make this dream a reality for the homeowner, who has put in their own sweat equity and contributed to the building of their new home, a news release detailed. MHFH is one of the premier institutions responsible for constructing affordable housing in the Permian Basin. The organization's partnership model offers deserving, hardworking families a hand up. MHFH uses a rigorous qualifying process that includes progress from the application through homeownership. Each participant contributes a minimum of 350 hours of sweat equity on the worksite and completes a home ownership education program. Successful candidates are then awarded a 0% interest mortgage, making homeownership a reality for some of the most deserving families in the Permian Basin. Anyone interested in supporting MHFH's efforts in the Permian Basin can contact Jeff Myers, Chief of Staff, at 432-686-8877. Obituaries. Bobby Jean Castleman Eads from Lubbock has passed away. Cynthia Lynn Kukendall of Austin passed away on March 24th at the age of 66. Steve Dale Conant, age 64, of Odessa, passed away on March the 13th. Peggy Grace Lee of Odessa, age 87, passed away on March the 23rd. Dolores Zuniga, age 86, of Odessa, passed away on Sunday, March the 26th. Margie Lee Jackson of Midland died Monday, March the 20th, at the age of 84. Dale Truman McCown, Jr., age 56, of Odessa, died Tuesday, March the 21st. Jose Luis Ramirez, age 62, of Odessa, died Wednesday, March the 22nd. Judith Marie Cawley, 76, of Odessa, died Saturday, March the 25th. Nancy Lou Fisher, age 87, of Odessa, died Sunday, March the 26th. Joseph Vincent Gibson III of Odessa, age 72, died Friday, March the 24th.
Minecraft Helps Sing Objects into Existence by Ruth Campbell. University of Texas Permian Basin Senior Learning Technology Analyst Curtis Rogers has a way for people to sing an object into existence using Minecraft and a 3D printer. Rogers said he's had the devices for a long time, but finally decided to put it all together so it can be shared with other people in schools. UTPB Associate Professor of Art Chris Stanley posed the question of whether Rogers knew anything about assistive technology to help people who are quadriplegic create things. He figured out that Minecraft could be used as a 3D application. Senior lecturer Doug Young programmed it. It turned out, in the education version of Minecraft, there is a special block in it that allows you to export 3D models in a file type that's compatible with the printer. That was the next part of the puzzle. We had the ability now to take and have the model built in Minecraft and export it in like a vegetable-based filament, which would then allow you to invest it and do bronze casting, Rogers said. At the time, he said, the only 3D printer the university had was one that would just do regular filaments. We now have clay printing and some other things available to us, Rogers said. So that was the second iteration. So now we know what 3D modeling application we can use because it's quite simple. The instructions are easy and people are very familiar with Minecraft. So there are plenty of resources out there. At the end of the day, all we're really doing is dropping blocks down. I built this world in Minecraft that only allows blocks to be built where we see these little brown boxes. The utility of that is this kind of box you see, this is the size that the 3D printer will do. It's the maximum size, actually, that this will output. Rogers said he taught music technology for a number of years at a college in New Mexico. I got to thinking, music is one thing that's really interesting because you have voice commands. We're used to that in computing. You can tell the computer to do certain things, but one thing that voice commands don't do a very good job of is they don't have any duration. But music does have duration. So, if I hold a note, I can continuously give commands. Just as if I hold down this W key, I can continuously instruct my character to move. Because it's the equivalent as if I were to just keep pressing down, he added. I was thinking, what if we were to take a music tuner and make it where you hit a certain note? It sends a certain command to the computer. Chris liked the idea and it seemed like it would be a viable idea because that's one thing you can do. If a person had no motor control at all, I only had control of my singing voice. I could sing an object into existence, basically. I use the keyboard to do it, but I can use my voice too, Roger said. This will give a student a chance to build something they can bring home that maybe they haven't been able to do before. He added that it could also be used by music majors who want to work on their pitches. They can sing into this thing as well and build objects that way, Roger said. He added that the other interesting thing is that you can disassemble something and turn it into music. I actually have the sheet music that built this mug. This mug was built with a voice, Roger said. He said their intention is to share the Singing Potter Music Control 3D modeling with the Bynum School and other educational institutions. I'm pretty excited about doing this. This definitely gives people a new, you know, a new avenue or approach on certain things, Roger said. Landgraf presents Wilson and Young Medal of Honor Highway Bill. State Representative Brooks Landgraf, Republican Odessa, is working to pass House Bill 2083 to designate a portion of Business Interstate 20 East in Ector County as the Mack Wilson and Rex Young Medal of Honor Highway. The legislation was discussed during a public hearing of the House Committee on Defense and Veterans Affairs on Thursday. Mack Wilson and Rex Young were two valiant Odessans who made the ultimate sacrifice for our country while fighting in Vietnam, Landgraf told the committee. The Wilson and Young legacy is very important to our community. House Bill 2083 would designate the portion of Business I-20 in Ector County between Loop 338 and the county line as the Mack Wilson and Rex Young Medal of Honor Highway. Landgraf filed the bill in February following conversations with veterans in Odessa who want to recognize these incredible local heroes who were both posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor by President Richard Nixon for their gallantry and valor in Vietnam. Both men are buried a few yards away from each other in Odessa's Sunset Memorial Garden Cemetery, located off of the portion of Business I-20 that will be renamed in their honor. Private First Class Wilson, a graduate of Odessa High School, was awarded the Medal of Honor for not only his heroic leadership on the battlefield, but for unhesitatingly deciding to jump on top of an enemy grenade, absorbing the force of the explosion with his body to protect his fellow Marines. Staff Sergeant Rex Young, a graduate of Permian High School, was 21 years old when several members of his platoon were killed after intense enemy fire. Staff Sergeant Young assumed command and directed his platoon to withdraw to get to a better defensive position, all while exposing himself to enemy fire. Staff Sergeant Young fired at the Vietnamese human wave attack, providing his platoon fire protection until his position was engulfed by the enemy. These men deserve every honor we can give them, Landgraf said. Veterans of the Vietnam War did not receive a warm welcome when they returned home, so it is especially important that we take opportunities now to make up for that wrong and honor heroes like Wilson and Young. I know of no other community of similar size that has two Medal of Honor recipients from the same war like we do here in Odessa. It makes me proud to be an Odessan, and I'm working hard to honor their sacrifice and bravery by passing HB 2083 this session. HB 2083 must receive favorable consideration in the House Defense and Veterans Affairs Committee before it can go to the full House for approval. The bill would then need to pass the same hurdles in the Senate prior to being sent to Governor Abbott's desk to be signed into law. Teacher invited to liftoff. Kimberly Neal, a sixth-grade science teacher at Wilson & Young Medal of Honor Middle School, has been selected for the prestigious Liftoff 2023 Summer Institute from June 25th through the 30th. Teachers invited to this program will conduct experiments, hear from NASA experts and astronauts, and network with other educators while sharing innovative lesson plans and ideas.
Dear Dr. Roach, I worked in a building from 1975 to 2002 that is now being torn down due to asbestos. The people who worked in the building didn't know at the time of any asbestos exposure. What problems could we potentially have? Should anything be done? This isn't good. Signed, LB. Dear LB, asbestos is scary. Most people know that exposure to asbestos increases the risk of lung cancer and, to a lower extent, an unusual cancer called mesothelioma. Viewers of the U.S. television see commercials for mesothelioma lawsuits frequently, although there are about 3,000 cases per year, less than the number of people dying in a week due to lung cancer or COVID. The people who are most at risk from this cancer are those who are exposed occupationally to asbestos. Many manufacturing and construction workers were exposed before the health risks were widely understood. Mesothelioma, in particular, happens 15 or more years after exposure. My limited personal experience with asbestos-related cancer included naval construction workers. Fortunately, the health risks to building occupants where asbestos is undisturbed and in good repair is not considered to be significant. Many buildings still have asbestos, but the risk to workers in the buildings is very, very small unless the asbestos is being actively repaired or removed. For most people, no testing is required, and there is no long-term health risk from living or working in a building that has asbestos. Dear Abby, I'm a 50-year-old man who has been divorced twice. The last one was 2 years and 8 months ago. Last year, I met a wonderful woman, and we have been dating and building a beautiful relationship together. A month ago, I proposed to her, and she accepted. Everything is going great, but I'm intimidated by all the men she has been with prior to us. She had a lot of toxic relationships and was sexually active with a lot of different men. When we have sex, she tells me I'm not assertive enough and she wants me to be more aggressive. It makes me feel like she isn't happy with me sexually and she will sooner or later look outside our relationship. Am I right to feel this way? I don't want to be in a relationship that will end because of our sex life. What should I do? Feeling inadequate. Good sex has everything to do with open communication between the partners. Your lady friend's past isn't a problem unless you make it one. She is trying to tell you what she needs from you. If you are not clear on what that means, ask her to elaborate. If it's not to your liking, be honest. But do not advance this relationship further until you get this worked out. Dear Abby, my daughter Claudia has been dating and living with Justin, the boy next door. They moved to Florida months back and loved each day together. Then the unthinkable happened. Justin's father was diagnosed with a rare disease and died 2 weeks later. His last words to Justin were, "Take care of your mom." Justin and Claudia immediately returned to New York. Each day has been a nightmare with his mom. She ignores Claudia and talks only to her son. Justin is 25 and hasn't lived at home for years. When she calls, she yells at him and he goes running to her. She no longer talks to us, although we had a nice relationship when her husband was alive. Justin loves his mom, but he's torn. What can my daughter do? Justin ignores how she's being treated and the tears it has caused. It breaks my heart. We love and adore him. Please help. Hurting for them. Dear Hurting, Justin is going through a painful emotional period right now. If you have any influence on him, express to him that you are concerned for him and his mother, that she may need grief counseling beyond what he can offer her, and that he might also benefit from counseling until things settle down. A licensed mental health professional would help him deal with his mother more effectively than he's doing presently, as well as provide him with a safe place to vent. As to your daughter, tell Claudia this period probably won't last forever, so she may want to give it time. If not, she'll have to decide whether she needs to move on.